Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Welcome to KCBS In-Depth, a discussion of one of the topics making news this week. This is KCBS In-Depth.
Baseball is in a time of transition. The games are getting longer and longer, and the crowds are getting smaller. Now, many are asking if America's favorite pastime might be in need of an update. On this edition of In Depth, we're going to search for some clues as to what may lie ahead for the sport by looking to its past. For that, KCBS sports anchor Steve Bitker and KCBS morning anchor Stan Bunger spoke with one of baseball's keenest observers, Tyler Kepner, who's the national baseball writer for the New York Times. They'll be discussing Kepner's new book, which examines the history of baseball through the lens of some of its most famous and most infamous pitches. Here's that conversation.
Our guest is Tyler Kepner, the national baseball writer for the New York Times and the author of the new book, K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches. Tyler, welcome to the program. And you write about the central nature of the pitcher, perhaps the single most important single player in all of our team sports.
Right. That's one of the things that makes baseball so fascinating to me, is that the most important player in a game is only going to play once every 5 days, and that's the starting pitcher. Now, we've seen the starting pitcher's job be changed a little bit recently with the opener strategy by the Tampa Bay Rays, but basically one pitcher will pitch the bulk of the game. And he can't pitch every day because of the nature of the craft. So it's very interesting to me how baseball works that way.
So, Tyler, you dedicate one chapter per pitch, beginning with a fastball and going all the way through the spitball. That's a fascinating way to write a book.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I felt like if I made the pitches themselves the characters, then I could sort of use all of the pitchers really throughout history to bring those pitches to life by talking about how they learned those pitches and how they applied them and why those pitches work for them and kind of just what the thinking is behind those pitches and the mechanics too. But it's definitely not a how-to book or anything. It's not an instructional guide. It's more just the stories and the origins behind all those pitches and the way they've evolved over the years.
And we can get a little deeper into how this is changing in the modern iteration of baseball, but a pitch is, you know, quite simply an object thrown by a human being, but these things have personalities of their own, and you delved into that in a number of ways.
Right. The particularly a pitch like the knuckleball, which is meant to be thrown with no spin, whereas every other pitch, it's all about spin and spin rate and how much you can get the ball to, how fast you can get it to move and how quickly you can get it to break. But the knuckleball is just a pitch that, you know, you throw off your fingertips and you try to kill the spin and get it to go in unpredictable ways. It's just completely different kind of pitching experience and hitting experience. And you know, other pitches have their own personalities too. In a way, you know, the changeup is a fastball, but you know, meant to be sold with the arm speed of a fastball, but it comes in and then all of a sudden it just dies and tails away because it's thrown typically 10 miles an hour or so slower than the fastball. So every pitch has a different purpose and kind of a different feel to it.
Tyler, you interviewed one guy that baseball fans in the San Francisco Bay Area feel a very strong kinship with, and that is former Giants manager Roger Craig. Can you share any anecdotes from your talks with him?
Yeah, well, Roger Craig, it's funny, he gets a lot of attention and credit for popularizing the pitch and really just spreading it all throughout baseball, the split finger fastball in the 80s. And you know, he talked about how it was a pitch that, you know, he pitched for a long time with the Brooklyn Dodgers and the LA Dodgers and the Mets and the Cardinals, but he never really threw that pitch, that sort of modified forkball. But he was looking for a pitch that he felt he could safely teach to kids at a baseball school that he ran in San Diego, and he saw Bruce Sutter throwing that pitch with the Cubs, and he asked Sutter's coach Fred Martin how he threw it, and it was really just a forkball, which is a pitch with your fingers split, across the two narrow seams. And he said this is a perfect pitch to be thrown safely because you just throw it like a fastball, and at the end it just basically dives right under the bats, falls onto the table. The irony, of course, is that so many pitchers ended up getting hurt, and in America, that was kind of a signal that, that pitch was a little too dangerous to throw, so it fell out of favor. In Japan, didn't really fall out of favor. They still throw it a lot over there. But yeah, Roger Craig really popularized that pitch with the Giants in the 80s.
So let's veer off into that debate about pitching and injuries, starting with little leaguers throwing curveballs, but all the way up to the big league level. And, Tommy John, who had a pretty good career as a pitcher, but will live forever because of the surgery to which his name was attached.
Yeah, there's definitely a debate about pitching injuries throughout the game, how to stop the rising tide of injuries and how to keep these guys healthy. The irony being that pitchers threw more innings in the old days, but didn't seem to get hurt as often. I think that does overlook a lot of pitchers who came up and threw a lot of was young and then were never really heard from again, probably from overuse. But we definitely think of that generation of pitchers who would go 300 innings or 250, 280 innings frequently, just like it was part of their job. Guys like Steve Carlton and Fergie Jenkins and Nolan Ryan and so many guys from that era. And it's just not done anymore. Nobody really throws more than 220 innings, if that. Anymore. So yeah, it's a real riddle in baseball how to keep these pitchers healthy, and some of the pitches have been sort of deemed dangerous, even if there's no real scientific backing for that. People say, well, the screwball will turn your arm inward, so nobody throws that anymore. They kind of just throw changeups instead. We talked about the split finger. There's always questions about the curveball at young ages. But if you talk to pitching coaches and even doctors, they'll usually say that a properly thrown breaking pitch is fine. It's just a question of being able to repeat the mechanics that you need to throw it, to throw it properly and in a healthy way. It's more the speed that hurts than anything. It's just throwing really, really hard too often and too young.
John Smoltz talked to you about the fact that pitching staffs are now comprised of multiple guys, multiple power arms, guys who can throw 100 miles an hour. And what this has in part led to is more pitching changes, more strikeouts, longer games, and fewer fans turning out.
Let me just quote from Bull Durham, Steve. Strikeouts are boring. Besides that, they're fascist. Throw some ground balls. More democratic. Crash
Davis,
1988.
Yeah, is this a major concern, the declining attendance in MLB?
Well, it should be, I think. Last year it fell by 4 million, I think, from the previous year. It was under 70 million. Now, it's still a lot of people who watch baseball, and if you compare it historically, it's doing pretty well. But we have two teams in Florida that really struggle to draw in particular. And across the board, it's down in most places. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But one thing that baseball has been trying to remedy is the pace of games and how long it seems to take these games. And so, they've tried to cut down on time between pitches and things like that. But I think, honestly, it's just now, nowadays, players are rewarded for seeing a lot of pitches and showing a lot of plate discipline. And pitching is really, really hard to hit. So there's more strikeouts than hits, and there's more foul balls than balls in play because these pitchers have advanced their craft so much to where it's just really difficult to do to hit a baseball. So the games take longer because there's just more pitches nowadays.
Hi, I'm Stan Bunger. My colleague Susan Lee Taylor and I love to ask questions.
How do we get packaging changed to something better? How bad could it get? What's the worst case scenario?
Our 10 Questions with Stan and Susan podcast is all about interesting people who have to answer exactly 10 questions.
What is that related element?
What's going on there? What's in there?
What's going to happen to all of this stuff of ours?
Find 10 Questions with Stan and Susan at radio.com. But baseball had managed through about 150 years of its history to always sort of find an equilibrium with a few exceptions. Are we at one of those inflection points where the game will have to be altered from its time-honored traditions to maintain some kind of equilibrium?
That's the big question right now, is if there is a breaking point, and if so, have we gotten there yet? You know, more strikeouts than hits seems to be a possible breaking point. We're on a record home run pace. There were more home runs hit in May of 2019 than any month in baseball history. So, you know, home runs are rising and walks are up again. And of course, strikeouts are always increasing. So, that just means fewer and fewer balls in play and a lot of waiting around for the one big hit. Now, that's not always how it happens in practice. I mean, there's plenty of singles and doubles, but there are fewer singles than before, and there's certainly fewer stolen bases and bunts and sort of nuance and things like that. So it's something that baseball's watching. I kind of cringe when I think about possible sort of you know, ways to manipulate the rules and the action. But then again, you know, baseball has changed over the years many times through its rules. So maybe there's something coming up. I mean, they're going to start looking at, automated strike zone in the minor leagues. In the independent leagues, they've flirted with the idea of pushing the mound back even. You could always make changes to the baseball itself. But all of those changes will be taken with a lot of care and nothing that can be done easily.
What about the change that they've already instituted in the minor leagues with, I believe it's starting in the 11th inning or is it the 10th, where there's already a guy at second base? In fact, my partner here announced on the air an historic minor league game. Tell Tyler about that last season.
Well, I should just explain by way of excusing myself. Tyler, so what happened, I was guesting as the color analyst for the Round Rock Express with the great Mike Capps calling the play-by-play, and this game suddenly alters. I go, what's that guy doing at second base? The game had gone into extra innings, and we were there, first time I'd ever seen the new minor league rule last season, where the 10th inning begins with a runner at second base, and you play from there. And what ended up happening was the first ever minor league game to end on a walk-off home run under the new rules. And it was hit by Cameron Rupp of the Round Rock Express at the time. But this is one, as Steve points out, one of the rules that they're tinkering with to try to, make games shorter, less stress on pitchers? What's the goal of that rule?
Well, the goal of that rule is to get games over quicker, but also to save pitchers from being put into situations that they're not used to, and that they're maybe not physically equipped to handle. If you get basically an emergency situation where you run out of pitchers, and then the risk is that one guy is going to have to throw more than he should, and he could get injured that way, or they'll have to put in a position player and basically concede the game. I don't think that will happen, but the fact that they have introduced it in the minors and in the World Baseball Classic is an indication of just how serious baseball is about that. I think that'd be terrible, personally. I think the long extra inning games are rare enough to where it's not a major problem, and that it's a lot of fun and memorable when you get to go to one of those games. If you want to leave early, you can leave early, but if not, you know, you might have a lasting memory of something really unusual and bizarre, and I think baseball has so many of those fun, quirky things that they should celebrate those and not try to artificially get you know, get rid of them.
Those of us who love baseball have already noted subtle changes to the game caused by the replay rule, right? People slide differently. There are different approaches to things because they know they've got this super high speed or, you know, super review system that can dig right down to the frame level and figure out if the fingernail came off the bag. But you write a little bit about the, some other subtle changes in baseball that have come with greater observation of the game, scuffed balls, doctoring the ball, things that might have happened in the past that don't happen now or might happen now that didn't happen in the past.
Right, yeah. I mean, you know, there's a really rich history in baseball of players trying to get an edge by scuffing the ball or throwing spitballs or Vaseline balls or something. Always illegal, but, you know, players figuring that they could get away with it. In the years since they banned the spitball in 1920, but now you know every pitch is measured so with such pinpoint accuracy about it how it's spinning and the axis it's spinning on and all that stuff. So if a pitch all of a sudden has an unnatural kind of spin, all the kids in the video room that you pay to break down every second of data will be able to, you know, find how he's getting it, find where he's where he's putting the Vaseline on the ball or how he's getting the scuff, and very quickly they'll be able to scope that out. So I know pitchers obviously, you know, will use some sticky stuff on their hands. They can get that pretty easily at various points on their body, their arms, their hats, their pants or whatever. But players generally look the other way because they kind of want the pitcher almost to have a grip. They don't want that baseball to slip from his hands and hit him, you know, in the head or something. But anything beyond just a general tackiness on your hands is frowned upon, and there's definitely a way to kind of subtly conceal stuff like that and get away with it. But if you're doing something that's going to fundamentally alter the path of the ball and the direction, then that's still against the rules, and you don't see much of that anymore just because, you're right, because of all those cameras just absolutely everywhere.
Tyler, I asked you earlier about Roger Craig, another guy with local ties, Dave Duncan. I mean, he was a fairly pedestrian major league catcher, but a very, very successful coach on Tony La Russa's staff for many years in Oakland and St. Louis, and had a great reputation for working with pitchers. What did you glean from him?
Yes, well, I made sure I talked to him. I covered his son, Shelly Duncan, when he played for the Yankees. He's just a great guy as a coach for the Blue Jays now. And I wanted to make sure I talked to Dave, particularly because one of the things Dave did so well was teach pitchers the value in weak contact, in putting the ball in play on the ground where the hitters can't do much damage to you. And that really stands in contrast with the way the pitching style that's in right now, which is throwing high fastballs and curveballs. In other words, throwing above the zone where it's hard to reach, and then down below the zone, to the high low, you know, the north south angle. And you know, Duncan has a lot of success with more of an east west approach, like busting them in and then getting them away, so they can really only get extra base hits if they're right down the line. So it was interesting to hear sort of the approach to, you know, a ground ball style, let's say, versus just a high strikeout style of pitching, and why that's kind of gone out of vogue here. But you know, I feel like Duncan was able to show that you know, there's still plenty of examples of ways that you can thrive by throwing sinkers and sliders rather than just high curveballs or high fastballs and curves.
We record history in the making every hour on KCBS. Now, we're digging into our archives to tell you how it sounded back in the day.
I have a tape recorder here in my hand.
It worked for a couple of seconds.
I'm Stan Bunker. Join me for the News Vault podcast, available through the radio.com app and wherever you go for podcasts. You picked up a lot of stories that sort of relate back to the same theme, which is kind of almost a tribal passing of knowledge from one generation to the next, from one team to the next, from a teammate to another guy, down to the kids in the minor leagues. I think the Mariano Rivera-Roy Halladay story about the grip, and Halladay supposedly carried a ball with an inked in, you know, here's where your fingers go to throw that pitch. But Is this still going on at the level that it did for all those years, or are the modern techniques, you mentioned the spin rate and the video breakdown and all of those things, are we still having tribal wisdom passed down, or now is it science being passed down?
Well, it's both, and in some ways, you know, the science is the new tribal wisdom. Like, you know, you talk to, I've been talking to Trevor Bauer lately for a story I'm working on. He pitches for the Indians, and he's very much a student of the science of pitching and of learning about pitch design through video analysis and through all the data points that you can find from that. And so he can learn pitches that way or refine his pitches that way. And then he does show other players. He has a video on his website where he's showing Kikuchi of the Mariners about how they, you know, he throws his changeup, for example. And encouraging other pitchers to kind of learn from video and data as well. So it's just sort of a modern outgrowth now of the old philosophy, which is, you know, if you know something, as a fellow pitcher, you should share it, because there's a good chance that the other pitcher you share it with won't be able to replicate it anyway, because he might have different, you know, biomechanics than you, you know, his physiology is going to be different. But there's sort of a unspoken kind of brotherhood where, hey, how do you throw that pitch? Can you show me the grip on that pitch? And then the other pitcher sort of obliges there. It's sort of something that's expected within their ranks.
And because you spend time sort of behind the curtain, where do these pitches get tried out? So Steve shows me a new grip for my cut fastball. How do I try that out, make sure it works before I have to stand in a game situation and deliver it?
Yeah, well, the bullpen sessions are great for that. Sometimes just playing catch, you know, on flat ground even. But then they'll take it to the bullpen and try to work on it there. But a lot of times that's where it ends, because when you get out on the mound, you really, it's all about conviction in the pitch that you throw and belief in that choice. And that's one thing I found very interesting, really, is that every pitcher will tell you that if you don't have absolute conviction and belief in the pitch that you're throwing, it's not going to be a good pitch. So if you go out there with any hesitation with a pitch that's still kind of a work in progress from the bullpen, you're not going to be able to succeed with it. So I remember talking to Dennis Eckersley about being a great pitcher during the you know, that split finger fastball era, and he never could throw it. And he tried, you know, he got a cast made of his hand with his fingers spread as far apart as they could, because he didn't really have a natural finger spread. And, you know, he put his hand in that cast all winter, hoping that, you know, he could develop that proper, you know, grip, the width on his second and third fingers, but it just didn't happen for him. And he's like, as much as I practiced in the bullpen, I was never confident enough taking it into a game in the ninth inning.
Tyler, you love baseball. Stan and I love baseball. Everyone in Japan and in Latin America loves baseball. But, man, the younger generation just doesn't love it like we did when we were younger. You talked in this book about, among other things, the rules that hitters are supposed to stay in the box, and they're enforcing this in the minor leagues, but major league umpires aren't enforcing what they're supposed to enforce. If they did, they could cut down considerable length in these games, correct?
In theory, yeah. You know, it's crazy that they talk about implementing that sort of thing, but the umpires really don't have much sway over it, or they don't. You never see it called. Usually, what happens is a player will get a letter, formal letter from the league, advising him that, you know, telling him what he's doing wrong, kind of a warning, and then maybe a fine later. But they're not really doing anything on the field, and for most of the players, the fine is minimal. So it really hasn't changed a whole heck of a lot. They can implement some of that stuff in the minor leagues, but anything you do in the major leagues has to be collectively bargained, and that makes things more complicated.
Baseball is still a multi-billion dollar business, but from where you sit, is there an existential crisis here? We've talked about attendance. This year, actually, things have kind of stabilized. I know 18 of the 30 teams are down, but a few are up. And overall, as of the time of this recording, Major League Baseball's average attendance for all games in all ballparks is only down about 500 fans per game. But Have we reached a point where the game has to really consider whether, as Steve indicated a moment ago, younger fans are growing up with the same geeky level of enthusiasm for it that maybe all three of us did?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things I hope can come from this book and hopefully future books that I write is kind of bringing back some of that appreciation for the history of the game and some of the greats who went before and understanding that what we're seeing out there is really just a continuation, another few links in the chain, really rich and interesting chain going all the way back to the beginnings. It's very important that baseball captures the young kids, but I've been hearing that forever since I was a kid, saying that baseball wasn't popular among the young set because it's too slow, and basketball and football and hockey are so fast and everything, and soccer is so international. But for all that, and as important as it is, I mean, I think we should remember that these are 30 teams that play 162 games, and with a system of several minor league teams all throughout the country, and they can sustain that. They can sustain a $10 billion industry. Enough people care about baseball to keep all those teams afloat, major and minor, and watch on national ratings, but all national platforms, but also local platforms and the app and everything. So I think baseball is still doing really well. Whether it was doing quite as well as it was before, maybe that's an issue. That's certainly something they need to keep an eye on. They've taken it internationally. They started the season in Japan. We'll be going over to England at the end of the month with the Yankees and Red Sox. So I think baseball's doing pretty well, but it could certainly do better.
Tyler, how do you feel about suggestions that the shift or portions of the shift should be modified or outlawed? Do you think it'll happen?
Again, that's one of those things they're looking at. I think that they will not end up doing that. I think that the game itself will self-correct, and that players who can go the other way will do that more often, and that skill will be valued more by teams because it's rare. You know, if we see the success, it's just in New York this year that the Yankees signed DJ LeMahieu, formerly of the Rockies, and everybody loves him because he puts the bat on the ball and he can go the other way. He's just a great professional kind of hitter. The Mets have a young guy named Jeff McNeil in the same mold. Maybe it's naive, but I hope that players like that who have good bat to ball skills and can beat the shift or not be shifted against, will start to command more money, and then that skill will be something that kids work on more.
Well, we thank you for the time. Tyler Koeppner, national baseball writer for the New York Times and author of the new book, K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches.
Once again, that was KCBS sports anchor Steve Bitker and KCBS morning anchor Dan Bunger in conversation with Tyler Koeppner, who is the national baseball writer for the New York Times. This has been KCBS In Depth. You can find past editions of the program online at kcbsradio.com or wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you heard, feel free to pitch a rating or review our way. We do appreciate the feedback, and it also helps other people discover the program. For KCBS and In Depth, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
You've just heard KCBS In Depth, a news interview program for All News 740 and FM 106.9 KCBS.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.